My name is Alex Behunin, and I'll explain later. In episode 5, I sit down with Ventura artist M.B. Hanrahan. We talk about her relationship with art, her multi-talented father, her famous Tortilla Flats mural project, her dreads, taking drugs away from artists, and much, much more. For more information or to contact her, please visit thembuniverse.com. Enjoy.
All right, I'm here with my friend MB. Thank you for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure.
So when I first met you, you were in a cast for your leg.
Oh.
How did you break your leg?
Okay, when I broke my leg, I was motorcycle riding. I was dirt bike riding. And I wish I could tell you how I broke it, but all I remember was I was going down a hill, and the next thing I knew, I was coming to, and my leg was bent in a very, it hurt more than anything else, and it was really bent. So I can at least have the cred of saying that I hurt myself doing something that was rad.
Right.
And it's so interesting. I learned a really good lesson, because I'm not really super coordinated, but I have gone out and done things, and usually they get taken out of my life because I eventually hurt myself so bad I'm all, well, I'm not going to do that anymore. Using my body as a vehicle for art, which I do. You know, I am a physical person. I'm a physical artist. I'm not, yes, a lot of work gets done mentally, but I am still at the place being, at least with the murals, and drawing, yes, but with the murals, where it's very physical. And I wanted to continue to do that. So you can imagine that when I was on crutches, I really did have to learn how to walk again, because I couldn't walk for 3 months, except for on one leg with the crutches. So, but at any rate, another time when I broke something or did something, and the doctor, I was like, oh, you know, help me out, blah, blah, blah. And she said, well, if you never do anything, nothing ever happens to you. So that is what I say. And then people go, wah, 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 wah. So yeah, so that's how it happened.
When you were on crutches, were you able to do any art, or were you basically,
you know,
artless?
I could draw and I could think, but sometimes those jobs come my way. Like for instance today, I was drawing and coloring a little picture. I might as well have been coloring in a coloring book, except that I drew it. So that's super fine, but honestly, unless something like that came to me, it was very, very, very challenging to do any work. I did do some work, and what I would do if it wasn't drawing is I'd get a drop cloth down on the ground, and I remember, and I put a canvas on the ground, and then I basically crawled around, because I would just drag the one leg that I couldn't use around with me, and it took forever. So often, you know, it was just so much work. I have to honestly tell you, I would just be like, well, I give up. So I would draw and think and read and do a lot of physical rehab, because most of my thinking, and this maybe does say something about me, is that yes, I am driven to do artwork, but I also am someone who at one point in time was sick of the art world and sick of artists and sick of the art, you know, of doing art. And I barely did any for 2 years after I got out of college, after I got my bachelor's degree in art, and I was cranking and everything was great. I was like, and I just stopped for 2 years. And then I had this, and I was, you know, on a road trip with my friends, you know, in a VW van, truly, 3 girls in a VW van going up the coast of California and into Canada. And it occurred to me that I should go back to graduate school. So I like to believe that there's only so long that I can go without doing it. There's part of me that wonders, you know, is either A, that the next lifetime, maybe I'm going to be a better artist, or the next lifetime, I'm not going to be doing art at all. My relationship, it's very odd. You know, I love art. I'm decent at it, decent. I do it, and people ask me, and I'm like, oh yeah, great. I actually have that creative, you know, spark. I'm not that good at anything else in this lifetime, really. But man, there is an ambivalence with me where I'm not suffering when I'm not making it. I was suffering more that I couldn't just get my car and drive when I had a broken leg, and I wasn't making any money, so that was a tough one. And again, but that's not a very positive thing to say about myself and my artwork, that was more what I was thinking. I just wanted to walk again. And that was like my main goal in life. You know, I don't know. I don't know if I'm a real artist, Alex, but I do art.
You're an artist. Just looking around. You're an artist.
Okay. This lifetime, but I'd be a liar not to say that I have an ambivalent attitude and wonder sometimes. When I was a younger person, I did art, I think in high school. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I was really just so satisfied smoking marijuana and sitting in a chair and reading. I was like, I'm cool. Like, doing nothing, basically. I like to read. So I'd be reading something like German book in German. or reading some, like Be Here Now and having my mind blown, or Clockwork Orange. So I would be pushing myself, but I don't know. So I think in the back of my mind that my inner stoner is there, the person that really just got C's and didn't really care about stuff. It's more that by putting myself out in the community, which is what I do, and I don't, yes, I care about my community. Yes, I know that ultimately being of service is the highest aim of the human heart. Yes, I'm much better when I am doing something for other people. Yes, 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 teaching, yes. But there is a part of me that if I did not put myself out there and did not constantly be in reaction to these wonderful opportunities for service, I think that the C student that would sit in a chair and just read and think that was fine, mm-hmm. eat peanut butter sandwiches, maybe drink some tea, that person's quite satisfied as well. So mm-hmm. now, here at this point in time in my life, I'm pretty much okay with and accept what appears to be, for want of a better word, the karma of this particular lifetime. You're good at art. That's the only thing you ever studied, besides German, and traveling. Yeah, like traveling and going places. Yes, absolutely experiencing that. But those people that are just so driven to make art and they're just like incredibly self-motivated, I'm all, so that motivates me as well. Beauty. I know.
Beauty.
Took off from that one. What were we talking about? Broken legs, and now we're talking about grand purposes in life. But I if people ask me to talk about art, I have to be real about it, and I wish I was a little more like, oh, this. But it's more like I just do it, and hence my career being quite varied. My story, I don't see it as much. I see other people that are like constantly motivated to paint paintings or something, and I'm like, that must be interesting.
I would think that being an artist, you have to be self-motivated.
Yes. It's creating one's own assignments. We were talking about school prior to this interview, and school was a good thing for me. I enjoyed the challenge of a theme. I enjoyed creative response to problem solving. So that is probably my nature of just, if there's a problem, I'm like, oh, I have no problem. I don't feel like it's a compromise. If someone says, well, this is what we're looking for, these are the colors we need, this is the theme, or you can come up with one, but it kind of has to serve this. It's like, with all the opportunities in this world, it's kind of nice to have some givens. And I guess that's all. That's art too, though, right?
Talk about growing up and your dad.
Okay, yeah, my dad. My dad's name is Jack Hanrahan. He is deceased. Rest in peace, Jack. He was a very interesting person, very, very smart, very clever, as they would say on the continent. He was a polymath in that he was very good at doing a lot of things, unlike his daughter, who was kind of good at doing about two things. But it was a tough act to follow. I was the oldest kid, so I was very fortunate to have a dad that just totally dug on his kids. That, you know, and totally me being, and I just say this, that I was born in 1958. That's not ancient times, but to know this, my parents were raised in a very more of a sexist environment than I grew up in. You know, by the time I was in school and in college, you know, there was like the 60s liberation and this and that, which I don't think still was that liberated for women, but it was a start. And in the 70s with feminism, you know, I saw it, I experienced it, I, you know, there was the material, there were the feminist artists. So I had that opportunity. But truthfully, whatever, my parents had that in their backgrounds, you know, and the fact that my dad, I never, ever, from either of my parents, because my mother, Rose Marie, being a very different person than my father, the artist, the kind of extroverted guy, the comedy writer, the dude that was insanely funny, the man that could just listen to music and then start playing it, would pick up instruments, could draw, could paint, could write, made his living as a writer, was gonna be a priest, and then, you know, gets married, has six kids, and the whole rest of his life had girlfriends. You know, always, you know, that he could approach his daughter in a very equanimous way. So there is a part of me that, fortunately, any sexism came as, it was like as an undercurrent that I was aware of, and that, yes, I've had to exorcise the sexist in my head, most specifically in being a collaborator, not thinking that the best I was ever going to do was, if it was the male artist that I was working with, that was going to be the best it was going to get for me, was to be part of someone else's career. And I did have to work on that myself, but I don't remember ever having any kind of message of discrimination that I couldn't do exactly whatever it was that I had to do and be how I am. That's pretty good. A lot of people have to work through that baggage. I think I worked more through a cellular baggage of sexism that was deep in my parents because that's how they were raised. It was a cultural deal that, and the timing of when I was born. But anyway, that's a whole nother story. So as long as I could remember, my serious memories of my dad was him sitting down, doing art, working with my uncle, illustrating and helping write greeting cards. They produced them. They silkscreened them out of a barn in upstate California. My dad wanted to be a television writer. He was writing for Mad Magazine. He was sending scripts out and somehow got a job, you know, working with various old school variety hosts. We moved to California in 1965. Thank freaking God. As a kid, I was so grateful that we moved to California. Like, I wanted to move to California even though I didn't even, I think probably because there was lizards there. But really, California is a much better fit for me. and I'm very fortunate. And I was a good fit for my dad. And so then in growing up, my dad was a golden boy, you know, an early success, probably much to his demise, because he did die as a drug addict, you know, and a homeless person, and untreated mental illness, which I'm not pulling anyone's covers here. My dad went in and out of mental institutions as a kid. I observed it. But all that being said, there's no denying the genius of the man. And I got to see him being a genius and got to see a lot of other artists being geniuses in various mediums, but very much in the entertainment business. And grew up in the 70s and 80s, a little bit in the 60s, but mostly 70s and 80s in the studio complexes of Southern California, all the major television studios and Disney as well. And my dad, you know, our fortunes fluctuated, so I did learn that as well. And I for a long time I said, and I don't know how true it is or not, but I chose not to have kids because I, you know, my dad would do what he wanted to do, whether we were poor or we were doing good. And I saw, I think that's pretty irresponsible, but I also know that the artist does what they're going to do, and the irresponsibility is having people dependent on you. And so to me, that meant my mom and my aunts were like models and singers. But what I also saw was this, the females in my family gave up their careers. So I like doing things. I liked doing things. I liked getting interviewed for the newspaper. I was a cute little kid. I was always doing wacky things. I'm a camera magnet. It's always been that way. So, you know, being an extra on my dad's TV shows, running on there, doing a little something as a kid, you know, it was fun. I didn't have fear about that. You know, I was a child puppeteer. I was very much groomed for the life that I have now by both parents. But with my father, it was like the extreme example of my mother's brother was a newspaper illustrator. And nobody was like, oh, art, what? No, it was more like, oh, that's what you want to do? Well, then be good at it. So art lessons, you know, after school. I was a jumpy kid. They're like, keep this kid busy. And very smart, very smart. I could have been a writer. People thought I was going to maybe be a writer because I was real good with writing, but I just don't enjoy sitting down that much. And so the fine art thing, I think, like I say, I felt like I could have done some other things, not music, but the art was just always something I could just pick it up like this. You know, I could just pick it up and it would stay, right? So.
Your dad just seems like just this character.
He was. You know, yeah, he was. Like, it was so funny. I mean, there's really something about growing up with humor, you know, and we're Irish American and that's part of the culture. But my dad, you know, and he would be no fear. He'd always be the one who was the MC. It always like, have Jack. Because he'd just get up and just start talking. He was very charismatic. Extremely charming and charismatic. He had his demons, and even as an adult, when I think about it, I'm like, wow, you know, he had to work really hard. I'm sure his doubts and everything that was in him that he, you know, obviously didn't deal with really, must have just been insane to be with, and then to write humor. But that is a lot of comedians and a lot of comedy writers. They say the same thing. It's a black place, and they.
Right, the way, right from their pain.
It's, yeah, or something. Or because they don't want to go that way. So they're like, well, this is what I have to do. You know, that I really think it was, but man, and also being media oriented, because again, I really am not drawn to constantly like watching movies and TV, but my dad really instilled that of how important it is to stay connected to what's going on in your society, even if you don't care about it. So you know what people are talking about. And what he would say to me is, there's just the same old stories, MB. They're just told different ways. So he'd watch movies. I'm like, why is the TV on all the time, you know? But he would just be constantly waiting for inspiration. You know, he'd just that typical thing. He would be driving, all of a sudden he'd pick up his little, you know, tape recorder, like we pick up our phones and blah, 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 blah. You know, it was just, it was brilliant to grow up and just see art and creativity integrated and traveling, having fun. My dad brought me to the New York World's Fair in the 60s. We were in New York City. I was a little kid. I don't know where we were. We were at someone's house. I have my little puppets. I'm playing with them going like, where are we? You know, and he's like, we're going to the World's Fair. Like my dad really, he thought like that was a great thing to do is just bring your kids, stick them here. You guys sit here. And then all of a sudden we're like watching like laughing being filmed, you know, we're like taped looking at the props and then get to see it on TV. That's an amazing thing to see behind the, you know, just behind the camera, just like, here it is. My dad, here, read the script. Tell me what you think about it. I'm like, all right, you know. And I stopped working with my father in the late 80s when I moved up to Ventura. Mm-hmm. Otherwise than that, from like the day I was born, you know, pretty much to that time, minus times going to school, but coming back and checking in with the guy because we always got along really great, I saw him working with partners. And I collaborate. So I believe that that's another thing I learned, which is an interesting, I mean, I feel that our society right now, collaboration is like the name of the game. Like everybody knows, even the single artist that puts out any kind of track, they always mention the producer, you know, they did not do it alone. Fine art, there are a lot of loners still, and there's that ego involvement, but almost all, as going back to what we were talking about, being is that my ideas and impetus come so much from that which is around me, whether it's walking up and down the Scavenue, you know, some goofy-ass picture that I take, something someone says, a challenge, me challenging my own self, you know, going, yeah, they look like they'd be fun to work with. And then coming up with some idea, the organizations that, you know, my ego is plenty fine. It is thriving. Right. You know, I come up with ideas on my own, but it's just so much more interesting to get a perspective or get a challenge from the outside that I love collaboration. I feel that I am better than my part when I collaborate with someone. But the collaboration could even just be the school that has an idea that wants me there, because they have an agenda. I just have to keep talking. Oh, no, it's your ideas. And I'm like, nah, not so much. I don't say that out loud. I'm like, oh, yeah, but, you know, what are you guys about? Oh, well, our slogan is this, and we love this, and you know what we're really about is this. I'm like, thank you. I can work with this now. We are now partners. Oh, look at this amazing thing. We did. Let's just take on that Native American, or I'm not quite sure where I got it, but that just of saying we instead of always just saying I. It's very helpful and truthful.
Was there a specific time that you remember that you were like, I want to be an artist?
It's such an old memory, Alex, that I would almost want to say I can't remember if I ever said anything else. It's such a wonderful term, right? Artist. The form of it has changed for me over the years, and I believe it will change again, and maybe it'll just be, you know, again, in a cast or something, just the idea, you know, that's fine, just the creative thought. I mean, not to diminish, anybody is an artist when they say they are. But, like, my mom would always go, like, oh, yeah, my kid's an artist, and they would say, oh, what kind of art she does? My mom would just go, oh, no, she's a real artist. Mm-hmm. Like, even my mom knew, like, don't say this, that. I'm forced, oh, a muralist, and then I'll go, well, and then I do this, 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 and it's like, why don't I just stick with the original thing, the letter A? I'm an artist, you know, and it's not egotistical. It's just the more truthful statement, because I don't care enough about the medium. Some artists really, they find themselves in their medium.
I'm a painter.
Yeah, I'm a painter. Or I carve stone. I've seen it happen. And even when I was a kid, I thought, that would be nice. But it's the ideas that I'm more in love with, and probably the process. And because there's too many times, even in very recent history, where the idea was not what I'm good at. I mean, excuse me, the form that the idea took was not what I was specifically good at. It's just like, that's what it was going to take to do this idea. And then finding the person that could do the metalworking, the engineer that would, you know, produce the computer drawings for me to get it okayed. I don't care. Here's my little sketch. Just do it like this. I know this will work. I know this will work. Just do it for me. Here, how much does it cost? You know, draw that thing for me and we'll hand it in. Boom, done. You know, I don't care. Do you have to do it? No, that would be great. You know, well, maybe I'll get, I don't know if there'll be a day where I don't have to paint these darn murals, but that would be nice. I could easily just sort of, like I said, kick back on my chair and point out some things, and I'd probably feel just fine. I would feel 100% ownership of it if it was executed by everybody else, but I'm not famous enough and rich enough yet for that to happen.
Do you have like a top five of your favorite art pieces you've done?
I usually will say that what the most meaningful project that I've been involved with and am still involved with, for longevity, for how it's developed, for where it came from, for what it continues to do, what it'll do before when I'm gone, would be the Tortilla Flats mural project that I am in partnership with Moses Mora. Whether I'm painting it or not painting it, he and I are in total partnership about it. And for those that are unfamiliar with that, the short version is, there was a neighborhood that referred to themselves as Tortilla Flats, a lower class, mixed heritage neighborhood. And we're talking from probably before the 20s, but we can safely say was in Ventura 20s, 30s, 40s. In the 50s, the 101 freeway was being built. It came through Ventura. This neighborhood was displaced. There was a diaspora of the inhabitants, and that was pretty much the end of the story until the early 90s. And I moved to Ventura in 1989. I had no idea, no, didn't know about this neighborhood for nothing. No pictures, no, never heard of it, nothing. My partner Moses, at the time he was called Michael Mora, but Moses Mora, he was telling someone else about his family's experience moving up the avenue when this neighborhood was displaced. He was a very small child, but he knew about it from his predecessors talking about it. He knew where it was. Obviously, it was right where the 101 freeway is on the west side of Ventura. That was neighborhoods all the way down to the beach. All the way down to the beach, there was a road that where we walk along the promenade. There was a road that people drove down, a dirt road. And buildings all the way, you can still see it if you look at pictures of from the pier from back in the old days. You just see buildings and houses right up to the darn shoreline. And so I was just flabbergasted with this information and turned to him and said those fateful words, this needs to be a mural. Mm-hmm. So with that kind of hearing a good idea and having those words come out of my mouth, I believe that shows you where my soul is at. We had no idea that it was going to turn into this a year of doing oral histories directly with the inhabitants, having a reunion of the former residents that don't even interact with each other, to tell their stories, to gather photographs from them, to person by person start a complete like legacy project and an oral history project, which then finally became a 500-foot long community project mural that was then taken down after 5 years because it was done on such poor materials, being that we started off with a $1,500 grant that we promptly spent on a party to get the residents back together again. Of course you would, right?
Right.
Well, that's, got it. You know, and then, yeah, then asked people for the paint and the wood that was just kind of substandard. And then 5 years after that was taken down, had an opportunity to do it on a larger, better funded, not well funded, better funded scale. Ironically, underneath the 101 freeway at Figueroa Street in Ventura. And then years after that, come to the concept of like, well, we need another mural, and doing now a 12 panel mural again on the west side of Ventura, on the side of a building that housed Tortilla Flats businesses at West Ventura, the South Ventura Avenue and 2 West Main Street in West Side Ventura, and doing that project, which is what we are currently involved in, using a different method of painting murals, working on it in my studio on Polytab, and then putting it up, Moses Mora and I choosing the images. So that is that goes from then say, we'll say 1995, the first one went up, so we started working on it a year or two prior to that. So say 92, 93, and it is now 2019.
A long time.
Yeah, and after this one gets done, who knows what we will do after that, you know, if anything. So that's a project that just kind of created itself and has created its legs and has just been 100% in response to a story that needed to be told. Creating a neighborhood's own history, creating history by creating art, and it's not exactly architecture, but some large scale public structures that tell the story.
Yeah. Talk about the holidays in MB Universe. Like, where did that come from?
Okay, I can totally that story. And again, it's good for you to remind me of these because there was no prior strategy to these projects that have been very long lasting. One day, out of nowhere, I got this idea of me. Oh, and I was also for fun, I would model for art classes. I just always have to say that because I would. I didn't need the money. I just didn't mind taking my clothes off and posing for artists. I had no problem doing that at all. I enjoyed it. And I, as someone who drew from models, I knew what a good modeling artist could do and what they should do. So I felt like I brought that into, for my friends and the artists I did not even know, that they should have me as a model because I at least knew what I was doing. Okay. So then, all of that adding up to getting this idea one day to pose in a pumpkin patch, nude, sitting on a pumpkin with a carved pumpkin as a head. I thought that would sound so funny. Where did this come from? Just came. So I'd seen an artist. I was teaching at Ventura College at the time. I had seen a photography show. I saw this one cat had taken these really nice black and white images using female models. I appreciated how he dealt with them. So I just put a note in a, I don't remember how I got in touch with him. I found out his name and I got in touch with him like, hey, would you be interested in me, me hiring you to take a picture? He's like, okay. And when I told him my idea, he's like, maybe it would be a little bit easier and we'd be running less risk of getting arrested if you could just create the pumpkin patch. I'm like, that's a great idea. So I just went out and bought a bunch of pumpkins. Used the garden of the backyard garden of the art studio I was at the time, which was Stoneworks. Set it up, carved the head. Had my friend, who was the whose studio it was, spin the head around because you couldn't see anything out of it, and it would just spin all crazy and go, "How do I look? That looks great." And we shot in black and white and in color. You don't see the pictures until you get them developed. When I saw it, I was like, oh, "This is so funny! I need to make this into a Halloween card for my friends." I can think of at least 100 people right now that I could send this to, and they would think it was the funniest thing ever. So that's what I did. Signed it, numbered it. I had been a print, I'd also done my share of printmaking, so that let's do a series mentality, which I never do in real life, but I do know for photographs and for prints, that's what you do, and you sign them. But that's what I did. Sent them out to my friends. And then I got hit up by the local newspaper here in Ventura, and they said, oh, you're an artist. We want to do a series, a little piece on artists' Christmas cards. And I was like, all right. So I thought of one idea, and I did it. I didn't like it. Did another thing. I didn't really like it. And I thought, what the heck, man? I'll just make myself into a Christmas tree. And so I called that photographer again. I'm like, all right, this is the deal, man. We're going to string me up with Christmas lights, and it's going to be all dark, but you can just set your camera. And then I did that. I did the same thing. I got the photograph for the, it was on the cover of the VC Reporter. So here we go, nude, but you couldn't really tell. Like, you knew, but it wasn't up, but I did the same thing. You could barely see my face, but you could kind of make it out. And then I was like, okay. And then I think the next one was maybe I think maybe it was like a 4th of July card or something. So it became a series that now I am still doing it. So that was 1996 was the Happy Halloween, the pumpkin head. And now it is 2019 and I'm still doing these cards.
And you got a book published.
And we self-published a book, which I'm very proud of, called Body of Work. So that's the story of the cards. We'll see. I'll keep doing them until my friends tell me, dude, don't take your clothes off in front of a camera. Don't do it.
That's great. I just have a few other things before
sure.
we get out of here.
Sure.
How do you deal with rejection in the art world?
To feel rejected. To feel rejected. And like so many things in life, one has very little control. It doesn't feel easy. You're like, how come they got it? But then the whole point is it was someone's opinion. It could have been someone's very informed opinion. But who's to say? To base one's sense of worth or what you're going to do with your life or your art based on the vagaries of public opinion, it's nice when you're riding high, but certainly not what you base one's self-esteem on. Maybe your work's maybe your work's crap. Maybe that's what to take away from it. I don't know. My father said, he said a couple things that I always remember. Is one, you're going to get credit for things that, for when someone takes credit for something you do, just remember you're gonna be given credit for a bunch of things that you haven't done. And I know that to be a fact. I know that to be a fact. He also said, don't jump on the bandwagon for popular opinion. He would just say, just stay doing what you're doing because your time comes, and when it comes around again, you're the best one at it. And I try to remember those words. So it's up to me to think that my work's good. It's up to me to push myself. It's up to me to not get them all butthurt because someone else picked so-and-so over so-and-so. What? It's people's opinions, Go someplace where they like your work. Then you'll be accepted.
Right. When and why did you decide to dread your hair?
Oh, good question. I always had very short hair and use that as a medium of radical self-expression. Well, my hairdressers did. I didn't do anything, but I'd let them. And I quite enjoyed it. I learned that when you typically walk around wearing coveralls, not being able to do your nails, that one has to find something that you can do that people are going to recognize. And my hair was always something that people would recognize. Whether I knew them, they're like, oh, they'd see me up on a ladder looking like a bomb painting. They'd be like, oh, it's that, it's her. You're that artist. You know, they would recognize me. That's excellent. Because I may not recognize people. My eyesight's poor. You know, I meet a bunch of people, whatever. So then one day I thought, oh man, this is a lot of work. It always costs me all this money. I'm always going in to get my hair done, which maybe one of these days I'm just going to have dreadlocks. It just occurred to me. What? Never probably even thought about it ever. You know, I like reggae music, but I mean, seriously, it never. And not a long-haired gal. You know, my hair always kind of looked like crap when it was long. I'd try. Nope. Cut it short again. So I had a double mohawk at the time. It was shaved on the sides. So I mentioned it to someone who's like, I know how to dread hair. I'll show you how. It's really easy. And so he helped me dread my hair. It was just on the top, so it looked like I had small firecrackers coming off the top of my head. And that's how it started. They'd come out. I'd redo them. They would finally stay. Then they started getting a little longer. And I was like, oh, maybe I'll just grow out my sides. And then my hair grew out in the sides. And I remember I dreaded my hair myself during watching a movie. And I'm sure it really annoyed people. Just by hand, I dreaded them my whole entire side of my head. And then it kept growing. And then, creature of habit that I am, I got attached to it. And my dreadlocks have also then done the same, they perform the same function. It's a lazy girl's hairstyle. I am recognized by it. I can kind of do a minimal amount of work to have a very cool looking updo. And there is power in having long hair, you know, and I tell people that it's not, they're my antennas. That's how I draw power from the universe. One time I had an illness that I'm cured from. But at the time, the only way that you got well from it, which didn't work on me, so I was spared. But I had to really work myself up to the fact that my hair was going to fall out. Mm. I mean, I thought about that I would rather have been sick and die from liver failure than have my hair fall out. And I was like, dude, that's wrong. You know, you shaved your hair off before, remember? And I was like, oh yeah, that's right. That used to be my get down. Super short hair, a crew cut. I managed. So then once I got to peace with that, then it didn't work anyway. And I got to keep my dreadlocks. But, you know, so like I say, even then, these might go. Someday, I am not my dreadlocks, but just for today, I enjoy them.
Right. And then lastly, so if someone makes art on drugs, right?
Oh, yeah. Great.
And the drugs are removed.
Yes.
Does your artistry stay?
Oh. Everybody has to come to that one themselves if they are someone who created on drugs. I as a little kid, I didn't create on drugs. I got older, I created on drugs. Then the drugs were removed from the story. There was a couple things I did. I was fearful. But how afraid can you be if you're useless and that's the only thing you know how to do? The only thing you're good at, the only thing you've ever been good at, so all your degrees are in it. Every job you've had, every job that I've had has been an art job, except for like working for a dry cleaners when I was 16 years old. I mean, every job, Alex. You know, so it's like, what was I going to do? I was going to learn how to do art again, not on drugs. So what did I do? Hung out with artists that were clean and watched how they did it. Immerse myself. Be in a studio with other artists so that you have that peer pressure. It's very difficult to be around people that are creating and not create if you have it in you. Not worry about it, you know? Get jobs where I had to be making art, so if I wasn't making art, I was making art. That muscle memory, you know, and there, to me, there is huge, yeah, now I have told you stories of getting inspiration. There is no doubt. I don't know where this stuff comes from. I try to say, lead an interesting life, you're gonna make interesting art. So that's a number one deal. Don't be boring. Now, I know there's boring people that make great art. I do know that. There's people that isolate and they make these insane things, but I'm not that person. I gotta be very stimulated, you know, very stimulated. And then it regurgitates through me and I come up with these ideas. It's very rarely about exactly what I've been stimulated with. Like I'm not making art about the books I read or the movies I've seen, very rarely, but, you know, or the newspapers I've read. However, I input. It just seems like that's the way it works, and then I get these ideas that who knows where they came from. So the doing of artwork is so much. the divine inspiration is a minimal aspect of it. I'm still doing things I was divinely inspired in for 5 minutes, one day, 1 minute, and now I'm doing the same thing 20 years later, 30 years later. It's not because I have no other ideas, it's just it sustained itself. It has a sustainability that I had very little to do. It just was popular, sustainable, still interests me, so I still do it. I'm not strategic. But I was fearful. I was fearful. But like so many things, you remember back when you did it and you didn't need the stimulus or you didn't need to be on drugs. Just keep making art. You'll eventually, there'll be some that are going to, a masterpiece is going to happen. Just keep doing it. Just keep doing it. This podcast may not be the masterpiece, but you're going to have some that are brilliant gems. Did you have any idea whether it was going to be a brilliant gem? No, it just happened to be that's the one. Or the one that you thought, meh, wildly popular. Wildly popular, y'all. Oh, don't you love this? Oh, sure. I had no idea that was going to be the popular one. Stay in that place. Just keep making art. Keep making art. Keep making art. You don't feel like it? Keep making art. Do art so much that you can roll out of bed and make art. I do that all the time. Maybe I'll start it before I go to bed so that I remember sort of something. But to think that I have to be divinely inspired and or feel good and or, feel anything to make some art, you can make some art. And then the habit, the new habit begins. I would lie not to say sometimes that I think, oh, it would be so nice. But the fact of the matter is, I've done so many different things to not even think that drug-induced habit isn't still in me. So truthfully, I'm grateful I've had all the experiences I've had, all of the experience I've had, because it's gotten to be where I am right now. And I am, whatever I may say about my career, whatever criticism I have, may have about my career, whatever ideas I have, like what I need to do for my career, fact of the matter is, a lot of people go to school, they never make art again in their lives. There's a lot of artists that are starving. There's a lot of artists that are afraid to do their art. They don't trust themselves. There's a lot of artists that have other jobs, and the other jobs take so much work that they barely do any art. I don't know if they're good. That's good or bad. For me, that's not the way it goes. To me, I make money with my art. I make a living with my art. My art is life. Life is art. I get other people to make art. Don't hang out with me if you don't want to make art. And I hang out with other people that are making art. And especially hang out with people that are better than me making art, so that I'm constantly getting that creative kick in the butt to continue on to the day that I fizzle out. And then, thank goodness there'll be this podcast.
Cool. Well, we're going to definitely have to do another one soon. Thank you for doing this.
Namaste, my brother.
Thanks for listening to the episode. If you enjoyed it, give me a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Or you can go to my website, alexbeginning.com. Until the next episode, goodbye.